Well, I'd say that we all like happy endings when it comes to the stories that we tell, the stories that we read. And as I thought about that, I was drawn to an exchange that takes place between two characters in the book, The Fellowship of the Ring. Again, The Lord of the Rings, if you've seen the films, you are not familiar with this because this is only in the book. But in the book, young Frodo, who is the hero, the hobbit, has gone through some very difficult experiences. And he comes to the city of the elves, and there he meets his uncle, Bilbo. And this exchange takes place. Bilbo tries to enlist Frodo to help him finish his book. He says this, "What about helping me with my book and making start on the next? Have you thought of an ending?" And Frodo responds, "Yes, several, and all are dark and unpleasant." "Oh, that won't do," said Bilbo. "Books ought to have good endings. How would this do?" And they all settled down and lived together happily ever after. "It will do well if it ever comes to that," said Frodo. And you can kind of hear in that little exchange, which is just a brief few lines in the book, this kind of back and forth between Bilbo's idealism, books ought to have a happy ending, and Frodo's realism, if it ever comes to that. Because sometimes we wonder that. You know, we all love the happily ever after ending, but will it ever come to that? Not every story seems to end with a happily ever after, at least not for all of the characters. Life doesn't always provide the happy ending. When we come to Lamentations chapter 5, if you're looking for a happy ending, it's not here. Lamentations doesn't end with some glorious redemption or some wonderful conclusion to the whole matter that ties everything together nicely. Instead, Lamentations just ends pretty much where it began. The book starts in darkness and it ends with shades of grief. There isn't a happily ever after moment because the pain of Jerusalem is still ongoing. This book is written from the ashes of a destroyed city. It's not as if this was written sometime afterwards where one could look back and reflect upon where it led. No, it's written from the midst of grief. And I think Lamentations does us a favor by ending in this way. Instead of having a happy ending that ties everything up, it's meant to minister to those who are in the midst of severe suffering. The truth is, if you or I are in a period of lament in our lives, we're not helped that much by someone coming alongside us and saying, "You know what? I know what you're experiencing. I've suffered too. I've been through difficult times of pain. But guess what? My life's good now. Everything's great. And guess what? Your life's going to be great eventually too." If you're a person who is suffering, you're probably just going to roll your eyes and mutter something like, "Well, good for you." Because it doesn't really help us that much if someone comes along and says, "Oh, don't worry, everything will get better eventually." At least not when you're in the middle of suffering. And if this book had ended with a happy note, sort of a little appendix on the end that says, "And they all lived happily ever after," we might say, "Well, good for them, but that doesn't help me in my suffering." There's another interesting thing when we come to Lamentations chapter 5. You'll notice that it has 22 verses, just like chapter 1 and 2 and 4. But it abandons the acrostic form all throughout Lamentations, and it's not always apparent in English, but in Hebrew it's very apparent. Each chapter is built around this acrostic letter-by-letter patterning. So you have the first verse starts with A, the second with B, and C, and so on and so forth. And no one knows quite exactly why Lamentations is built that way, but I suggested at the beginning of our study, I think it's because there's a sense in which the author is trying to make sense out of what's happening. And putting it in alphabetical order helps to at least bring some kind of order to chaos. Then we get to chapter 5. Even though it has 22 verses, he abandons the acrostic form. And I would suggest there's almost a sense in which the author, probably Jeremiah, is saying, "I've tried to make sense out of this tragedy. I've tried to try and put the pieces together and make some kind of order out of it, but I can't. I can't." And again, I think that goes to this, I hate to call it an unhappy ending, but a not happy ending. No, he doesn't have some beautiful answer to all the questions we might have. In fact, the book ends with even more questions. I've tried to make sense of this, and I can't. So Lamentations ends in the same desolate place where it began. But we should not conclude from that that lament is eternal, that we're just doomed to go on weeping forever. The sun will never again shine. So the question for us, I think, and really as you end this book and you see that suffering is still happening, you might wonder, when will lament end? When will lament end? Is it something that just goes on and on? Is trauma and grief and suffering something we have to carry forever? Or does lament end? The truth I want us to explore this morning is this. One day lament shall end, and we will rejoice forevermore. Now, to someone in the midst of suffering, that might sound, well, that's great. That sounds like a great thought, but that's not my experience. But one day lament will end, and we will rejoice evermore. I'm not trying to say that to short-circuit lament. I'm not trying to say, hurry up and get over it. Things are going to get better. But even in this less than happy ending in Lamentations, it points us to a time when lament will be no more. So let's explore this a little bit. And I want us to really think about when lament ends and frame it like this. Lament does not end until. So let's look at number one. This is in your outline. Lament does not end as soon as we would like. When it comes to lament, when will it end? Well, not as soon as you would probably prefer. Perhaps we hope that life's trials and the miseries that we face would be over quickly. We would hope that grief and sorrow would pass quickly. But if there's one thing that we learn in the throes of lament, it's that it lasts longer than we would like. And this, I think, separates the kind of sorrows over which we lament from the inconveniences. We can learn to live with inconveniences. We can learn to cope with tough situations. But when life falls apart, when things are really dark, you don't just get over it. It takes time. Lament is not a quick in and out. It's not something we do and then move on to other things. By the time we arrive at Lamentations chapter 5, we've gone through four whole chapters of lament. And you might be wondering to yourself, well, we're finally to the end of this book. Where's the end of lament? I'd like to see some kind of resolution to all this. But no, it's just more of the same. And that's, again, part of, I think, the whole point of Lamentations is to show us that lament does not end as soon as we would like. We've seen for four chapters the complaints of the author. We've seen the anguish of Jerusalem. We've seen the pain of loss. And now we're thinking, look, get on to the positive stuff. But to insist for that is to insist that lament be shortened. Lament can't be shortened. I want us to see this in Lamentations 5. I'm not going to read the whole chapter. Again, what you find here, and I hope that you will go back and read the whole chapter, what you find is actually very reminiscent of what we've read before. So if you read chapter 5, you're going to think, wow, this sounds so familiar. Why? Because we've read it for four chapters. But it continues. And starting in verse 1, it says, "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers. Our homes to foreigners. We have become orphans, fatherless. Our mothers are like widows." I'll stop there with verse 3. But you'll find the rest of the verses continue very much in that line, talking about what we've suffered, the agonies that we've endured, the disgrace that has been piled upon us. Again, it all sounds so familiar because we've read it before. Now, he begins in chapter 5 by addressing the Lord directly. You see that? "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us." So rather than talking to us, the reader, the author, probably Jeremiah, speaks directly to the Lord. He cries out and says, "Lord, remember us. Look upon us." God has no need to remember. He knows all things. But the plea here is to look and to see. Look and see our disgrace, he says. God is all-knowing. God is all-seeing. But this is an invitation on the part of Jeremiah. He's saying, "Lord, don't just look and know as if God didn't know." He's saying, "Have compassion on us. Look on our disgrace and show compassion. You know, there's something about looking and seeing and remembering that moves someone to action. That's why if you watch TV, you'll occasionally see a commercial for St. Jude's Children's Hospital. And there will be these children on there, and you know, who are suffering, who are being treated for cancer and various things. And I mean, it's there and it's shown to you in order to elicit your compassion. Here are these children who need your help. Please give. And it's kind of like that's what Jeremiah is doing here. Lord, look on our disgrace. Look at us so that you might have compassion, so that you might do something. Look on our disgrace. And then for the next 18 verses, or 17 verses really, starting in verse 2 to 18, he describes this disgrace. Look on our disgrace. Here's what it is. Our inheritance has been turned over. He talks about being stomped on by his enemies. He says in verse 8, slaves rule over us. He talks about the torture and the torment they've experienced. Again, we could go through it all, but I want us to get to the final verses of this chapter. The point is, lament lasts longer than we might like. Here's a good summary of what they've endured. Verse 15, he says, the joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned to mourning. You probably notice in that verse there's a reversal of one of our favorite verses. Psalm 30, verse 11 says, you have turned mourning into dancing. You've loosed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness. That's Psalm 30, verse 11. You've turned my mourning into dancing. Well, here he says, you've turned our dancing into mourning. Joy has been sucked out of our lives. Despair has taken over. Now, you would hope by this time in Lamentations, you know, after five chapters, that dancing would have returned. But no, lament lasts longer than we'd like. However, Jeremiah is not naive here. He's not saying we've suffered meaninglessly or without cause. Go back to verse 7. He says, our fathers have sinned and are no more, and we bear their iniquities. Now, I don't think that Jeremiah is suggesting here that, well, our fathers have sinned and we're having to pay the price, and, you know, woe is us, we've done nothing wrong, we're being punished for our father's sins. No, I think what he's doing is he's placing their own sin within the context of those who have gone before. In other words, our fathers have sinned, their iniquities are being punished, and eventually the hammer of God's judgment had to fall. And the fact that God had been gracious and gracious and gracious, and now the judgment has come. He's saying, we have sinned, and so have our fathers. So it's an acknowledgement of this judgment that's finally come. It's not just complaining. You know, sometimes, especially nowadays, I feel like a lot of younger generations, like millennials and below, like to blame the baby boomers for everything. You know, the boomers are the ones that have you know, done this to the economy and done this to the housing market and whatever. That's not what he's doing here. He's not just blaming previous generations. He's saying, we along with this long line of iniquity suffer the just rewards. So lament lasts longer than we would like. And let me just say that this is not only in the case of this book and this kind of national tragedy, personally, lament lasts longer than we'd often like. People sometimes wonder when they've gone through a tremendous loss, the death of a loved one, and they think to themselves, shouldn't I feel better by now? Why do I still feel so sad? Why do I still feel so depressed? The fact is, there's no orderly way in which to lament. Let's note a couple of things about this elongated lamentation. First of all, lament is a process. It's a process. It's something that we have to work through. Many years ago, there was I think a psychologist named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she made famous these stages of grief. You've probably heard them before, and I think they're pretty accurate, not because she discovered something new. I think she just put labels on something all of us inherently knew. And that is, five stages of grief, as she laid them out, were denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And even she recognized it's not a linear. It's not like you go from one to the next. Sometimes they're mixed together. The fact is, it's a process. When we lament, we talked about the process earlier with the with our little acrostic that we're not acrostic, but our little teaching mnemonic device. Teach, right? Turn to God. Express your sorrow. Ask for God's help or God's action, and then hope in the Lord. You can see it's a process. Lament itself is a process, one that is supposed to lead us from anguish to trust. As a process, secondly, lament is a long process. It's not something that quickly comes and quickly goes. It's something that takes time, and we ought to be comfortable with that. We ought to be comfortable with the fact that lament is not something we rush through. And it shouldn't surprise us when someone deals with grief and loss for a long time. It's a long process. Third, it's a complex process. It's not simple or, you know, easily understood. It's not linear. Oftentimes it's messy and complicated. Here's the point. Lamentation does not end as soon as we would like. This book perhaps is uncomfortably long. Only 5 chapters, but you feel like, wow, this is hard to get through because it's so depressing and dark. But lament doesn't end as soon as we would like. It lives with us for a long time. Let me give you just one example. Some parents will go through a messy and difficult divorce, and they think to themselves, well, you know, our kids are tough. They'll manage. They'll get over it. Well, research would indicate that even well into adulthood, children will still struggle with a parent's divorce. It's not like, well, you know, we went through that and now it's over and now we've moved on. That's a very traumatic thing for a kid to go through. And even adult children, when their parents divorce, oftentimes it sticks with them a long, long time. Many will say, my parents' divorce messed me up, because it is something that lasts a long time, a lot longer than we might like. So in answer to the question, how long will lament last? Probably longer than you expect. So if in your pain, you wonder to yourself, why does this still hurt? Why don't I feel better? Just know, lament is not something to rush through. However, does lament come to an end? Yes. How long will lament last? Secondly, lament does not end until God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. Lament does not end until God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, lament will be a regular part of our lives. Notice I said regular and not consistent. Consistent would imply that we just are lamenting all the time. That's not normal. I think we should have times of joy and gladness in our lives. The fact is, as long as we live in this world where sin runs amok, we can expect that there's going to be periods of lament, that we are going to go through periods of sorrow and sadness and anguish. And we will until God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. I want us to walk into the last few verses of Lamentations chapter 5. Verse 19 is a turning point. It says in verse 19, "But you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations." I love what one author states here. He says, "This prayer reaches its climax in an astounding leap of faith across the chasm of defeat, destruction, and death. The prayer reaches out from the ruins of God's dwelling place on earth and touches the eternal throne of God in heaven." So 18 verses we have, woe and pain and hardship. And then in verse 19, he says, but you, O Lord, reign forever. He begins here with a confession. He looks up is what he does in verse 19. He's looking around and everything is in ruins around him. And he looks up and says, but you, O Lord, you're on the throne. And there's something very healthy about us looking upward in the midst of our suffering. I like these words. This is from John Calvin many, many years ago. He wrote, "When we fix our eyes on present things, we must necessarily vacillate, as there's nothing permanent in the world. And when when adversities bring a cloud over our eyes, faith in a manner vanishes. Now, the remedy is to raise our eyes to God. However confounding things in this world may be, he yet remains the same. So look upwards. Jeremiah, the author here, looks upwards and he says, "But you, O Lord, reign forever." That's a tremendous confession when you think about the setting. You know, he's just talked about how everything is in ruins, everything is in destruction. You know, he's sitting upon essentially the grave of Jerusalem. And he looks up and he says, "You, O Lord, reign forever." What a curious thing to say. Because you would think the logic would go something like this: Lord, if you reign forever, why is this happening? If you're in charge of everything, why are we in this circumstance? Couldn't you have done something? Couldn't you have rescued us? Couldn't you have changed this? He says, "You reign forever. His throne endures to all generations." In other words, God is and always will be on the throne. He rules over the universe. He is in charge. And I think there's something very good about our lamentation if it turns us to this truth. We need in our lament to be reminded that God is in control. And sometimes that's the only thing you have in lament. You say, "God, I don't understand this. I don't like this. This is painful and difficult, and I cannot see the light, but I trust you're in control." That's all I'm holding on to, is that you must have some plan. I can't see it. I don't know it, but I trust that you're in charge. We believe that God is sovereign and that he loves us, then we can't help but see that our anguish must have some purpose, even if we don't grasp it. This confession, though, is followed by a complaint. So he acknowledges, "Lord, you reign forever. Your throne is to all generations." Then he says in verse 20, "Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so many days?" So here's the complaint. Why, Lord? Why? That's the question we run into again and again in this book. Why hasn't my lament ended? Lord, you're enthroned on high. You're in control. Why don't you stop this suffering? So there's a gap between what Jeremiah feels and what he knows, isn't there? He knows God is on the throne. He knows God is in charge. But as he looks around, he says, "I feel forsaken and abandoned and utterly desolate." How do I reconcile these? And that leads us, so we see the confession, the complaint, and then the conflict. The conflict between those two. The tension that's here in the air. Lord, you're in charge, but I'm suffering. How does that make sense? I detect in the words here something like what we read in Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9, there's an interesting episode that happens. A father with a demon-possessed son comes to Jesus, and he asks for Jesus' help. And Christ, rather than offering to immediately heal the boy or to cast out this demon, says, "Oh, what a perverse generation this is." And the man responds in a remarkable way. He says, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." In other words, "Jesus, I know, I believe that you can heal me, but I know my faith is not all the way there." And I detect something like that here with Jeremiah. He says, "I believe you're in charge, God, but I also feel this way. I believe, help my unbelief. Help me understand. Help me wrap my heart around this why question." See, God reigns in heaven, but one day his reign will be experienced perfectly here on earth. And that's where I get the line for that. We're to pray, right? "Your kingdom come, your will be done on heaven, on earth as it is in heaven." How is God's will done in heaven? Perfectly. It's carried out perfectly. Now here on earth, there's sin and corruption, but there is coming a day when God's kingdom will come and his will be done on earth just as it is in heaven. In other words, there's going to be a redemption. There's going to be a coming glory. So this conflict is resolved in the coming of Christ. So when will our lament end? It will end when Jesus returns and his will is done on earth as it is in heaven. That's when our lament will end. When we finally get to that point of no more. No more. It's a great couple of verses in Revelation 21, verse 4. Revelation 21, of course, is pointing ahead to the new heavens and the new earth that come. But it highlights a couple of no more statements there. It says, he will wipe every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning or crying or pain anymore. All the former things have passed away. So there's this day when there will be no more of these things. And you can put in there whatever you like. There will be no more disability, no more cancer, no more Alzheimer's, no more childhood deaths, no more whatever affliction, no more depression, no more anxiety or panic attacks. And the list goes on. There's a time coming when Christ will reign and his will be done on earth and those things shall be no more. You know this from the song, right? No more shall sin and sorrow grow, nor thorns infest the ground. And we sing that at Christmas time, but it applies here. No more. That's the day when lament will end. Now, I don't mean that we have to wait until that coming kingdom for us to cease crying. Hopefully there's much laughter ahead for all of us here in this life. But there's also much tears ahead. I know that. And the day when Jesus comes, and tears will be no more. So when we look at Lamentations 5, 19 and 20, it's this interplay. Lord, you are enthroned forever. We should turn our eyes upward. But guess what? We're also looking for the day, not only when you reign on high, but also when your reign comes here to earth and our lives are changed and righteousness rules. Mentioned God enthroned forever. Lamentations is recognizing something that anchors our heart in the midst of our sufferings, but also points to the day when lament will end. And asking that question, when will lament end? Here's the third thought. Lament does not end until we are fully restored to God. Lament does not end until we are fully restored to God. I know this kind of overlaps with the previous one. But someday, you and I are going to be fully and finally restored. And then there never will be any more lamenting. No more crying, no more loss, no more pain. Not only will Christ's kingdom come and his will be done, but you and I shall be changed if we are in Christ Jesus. We're not just looking for creation itself to change and sin to be defeated. We're looking for the day when we personally are done with sin and suffering. So look at verse 21. Lamentations 5:21 says, restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. So the request here is restore us. Restore us. I detect in this a bit of repentance. He's not just saying restore us, Lord, because we deserve it. He's saying restore us. We recognize this disaster has come upon us because our sin. Restore us to yourself. Isn't that important? He doesn't say, restore us to our land, restore us to our prosperity. He says, restore us to you, O Lord. Bring us back. In fact, this word restore, it's used twice in verse 21, means to turn back or to return. Return us to yourself, Lord. That's where it starts, in a relationship with God. Being restored, returning. And then he says, and we shall be restored. I think that's talking about their coming back. Remember, what has just been lost? Jerusalem, the holy temple, all that the Jewish people held dear has been ripped out from under them. Now he says, restore us to yourself, Lord. Bring us back to you and bring us back into our land, into all that we have hoped for. Now, Jeremiah elsewhere prophesied that 70 years would pass in exile, that they would be in Babylon for 70 years, and after that time, there would be a return. They would be restored. But here's the interesting thing. The prophets all talk about this. And it does happen in the Old Testament, partially. Right? The people do return to Israel. The temple is rebuilt under Zerubbabel. The city is rebuilt under Nehemiah. So they are restored. But it's clear that not all that the prophets had foretold is here yet. There's still something lacking. And I think what's lacking is that restored unto God. Now, there were individuals like Nehemiah, like Daniel, who had a very close relationship with God. But as a whole, the nation still was in rebellion. I mean, what happened when God sent his one and only son into the world to testify of the truth? It says his own rejected him. They crucified him. So yes, there is a restoration that happens here, but only partial. There's a full restoration coming. And I think there's an analogy there for us. Because if you have trusted in Jesus, you have been born again. You are a restored person. But guess what? You're still in this sinful human body, right? So you're restored. You have a relationship with God. You are bound for heaven. But we're still dealing with our sinful flesh. We still have temptations and sins in our lives. We still have these weak human bodies. But someday the full restoration is coming, when we will be raised incorruptible, when we will lay aside mortality and put on immortality. There's a restoration coming. Then, last verse, verse 22, says, unless you have utterly rejected us and you remain exceedingly angry with us. I told you this book doesn't have a happy ending. And in the last verse, it almost seems to cut out any happiness that we might have had. You know, God's on the throne, we're going to be restored, yay. And then it comes in with this. Now, there's two ways to take this verse. It could mean, unless you have utterly rejected us, as in a condition. In other words, restore us, God, unless you just are sick of us and you don't want us anymore. Or it could read, even though. So even though you have utterly rejected us and remain exceedingly angry at us. I think it's the latter. I think even though is the better translation. Because what he's saying is, restore us to yourself. He's looking forward to this glorious restoration when things are made new. But he says, even though at our present time, you're still angry at us. We're still in the state of being trampled upon. But I'm still looking ahead to this restoration to come. And folks, we need to be finally and fully restored unto God. It begins, first of all, by trusting in Christ when that initial restoration takes place and you are changed from the inside. But we're looking forward to a day when suffering ends. I was mentioning to someone this morning already that I'm just kind of cresting into that age where stuff just hurts. Like, you don't even have to do much and it hurts. I played badminton for 10 minutes yesterday, and I'm noticing, man, I was playing barefoot, so it was kind of my fault, but I'm like, man, my feet kind of hurt this morning. I wonder what that is. And sure enough, it's playing badminton for 10 minutes. It's like, that never would have bothered me when I was 20, right? But it's starting to get to the point, and I'm sure all of you are probably thinking, just wait, Reed, there's more to come. But, we all experience that. Things break down. We have pain in our bodies. Things don't work like they should. But not only that, we also experience loss and hurt, and other people sin against us. All of that is going to be redeemed. There is a restoration coming. We've been made a new creation. The old has passed away, the new has come. We've been made new, but not finally and not fully. Romans 8:18 says, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory to be revealed in us. A few verses later in verse 25, it says, but if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So we're waiting this day when we're finally and fully restored. And that's the day when lament will be no more. There's not going to be any more tears. When we are finally and fully restored to God, when we are made new. So lament has an end. I can promise you this, though. There will be seasons of suffering and trouble in your life. And lament can help lead you to hope and trust in God. It is the right response. But we long for a day when lament is no longer needed, when all is made well in the world. And I hope this study on Lamentations has been helpful to you, kind of thinking about how we respond to affliction and how we hope in the Lord. But I hope what it does more than anything else is it presses you in a longing to see all things made new when we are finally and fully restored. It should drive us to the happy truth that someday lament will be over. Every tear dried, every pain banished, all of our worst moments redeemed. So I guess there is a happy ending for those who are in Christ Jesus. We who live to see the redemption of all things. So I began this morning with a quote and a reference to the Fellowship of the Ring and this conversation between Frodo and Bilbo about happy endings. I want to close with another selection, again, from the books. This one from The Return of the King, the last book in the series. Again, this is not something that's in the film, but it's in the book. When the final evil ring is destroyed, Sam, who's one of the hobbits, he wakes up having he survived this whole ordeal, and he wakes up, and the first thing he sees is Gandalf, the wizard, his friend. And he exclaims, "Gandalf, I thought you were dead. But then I thought I was dead myself." Then he says this, "Is everything sad going to come untrue? What has happened to the world?" It's this question, you know, all this sadness, all this darkness that we've just been through, is it going to become untrue? Well, it's not going to come untrue in the sense that it's going to be undone, but it will be redeemed. Gandalf responds to Sam. He says, "A great shadow has departed." And then he laughed, and the sound was like music or like water in a parched land. And as he listened, the thought came to Sam that he had not heard laughter, the sound of merriment, for days upon days without count. It's clear that all that was sad will not become untrue, but the shadow has departed. And we may yet see all that is sad redeemed. And the truth is, even if you're lamenting today, you will laugh again. And you will say along with Sam, "I feel like spring after winter, and sun on the leaves, and like trumpets and harps and all the songs that I have ever heard. Such joy is awaiting the children of God that all the sadness and all the lament," which is a legitimate response for us in this fallen world, "all of that will be washed away, and we shall be made new."